We're on page 28.
Coming back then to page 28, I think I must expand what I said there, because it gives quite a false impression. I said no, deployment of manpower just wasn't being thought about at that time. Well, it was, but those terms weren't being used.
Yes.
The situation, I think it would be true to say, was that when where voluntary organizations were concerned, adequacy of manpower wasn't thought much about.
Yes.
There were, on the whole, more people available than you could employ. And there was no very strong feeling anyway about employing trained people.
Yes.
And of course, if you're not concentrating on trained people, the supply is much more unlimited than if you are.
Yes.
The Institute of Almoners before the war was limiting the number of almoner students because they were afraid of overproduction. And the people would be unemployed.
Yes.
Probation was able to keep a pretty even balance.
Yes.
They were usually short of men for training, but not short of women. That changed, that balance changed after the war. The child care service, of course, didn't exist until after 1948. Remember also that medical and psychiatric social work were not universal services.
Yes.
Whereas probation and child care were universal services which had to be provided. And this has a very considerable bearing on deployment, which tended to be called much more questions of supply and demand.
Yes.
For instance, if you read the McIntosh report, the report of the Committee on Social Workers in the Mental Health Services, I was a member of that committee, and I think, as far as I remember, there were two PSWs in the whole of Wales.
Yes.
This was the kind of situation.
Yes.
And we had a lot of discussion on that committee, I remember, as to whether if more local courses were started.
Yes.
In those days there were only three, LSE, Manchester and Edinburgh. Yes. Edinburgh from 48. If more local courses were started, whether more people would be recruited.
Yes.
But on the whole, it wasn't thought of as an urgent problem, the shortage of trained social workers, until, I think one could probably say, the start of the child care service.
Yes.
When the Central Training Council in Child Care did begin to think about matching supply and demand.
Yes.
The Probation Advisory and Training Board certainly thought about it. We used to have figures at every meeting of the board.
Yes.
Showing what the wastage rate was and what the new recruitment was. I remember one meeting, there was a figure for the wastage rate, and I said, what did this include? And found that in fact it included the newly appointed Secretary of the National Association of Probation Officers and the newly appointed Home Office Probation Inspector.
Yes.
So then I suggested that this should be broken up into those who really were wastage and those had gone into another part of the service. Anyway, I think you've got a situation in which when the new universal services began and when government departments started to be involved, then you got much more acute awareness of problems of deployment.
Mm.
But there is, as far as I remember, a certain amount in those two Carnegie reports of mine about the few social workers in the north of England compared with the south. Later on we used to call them desert areas.
Yeah.
And later on, there were terrific efforts to get courses started in desert areas and so on.
Yes.
But this is on the whole post-1959. So, let's say that that's... one other thing I want to say. You were trying to get me to say things in this discussion, and I was saying no, no, no. But very largely, I think, because you were using terminology, mm-hmm. which I knew not to be the terminology of the period. For instance, management studies.
Yes.
Just unknown.
Yes.
It was only when you began to get these large-scale services that you began to think about management.
Yes.
And remember that it didn't become really general, management studies and the whole emphasis on it, until after the CBOM legislation.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Even, remember that local probation services really were very small.
Yes.
London, of course, was much the biggest.
Yes.
But there again was terrific conflict in the 1930s between the probation officers and what became headquarters, because up till, I think it was about 1929, there had been no central London service. It was all the local courts and the local probation officers, and the juvenile court probation officers were answerable to the Home Office.
Yes.
Not to any probation service.
Yes.
And then in, I think it was 1929, doesn't matter, it was around that period, a principal probation officer for London was appointed. Guy Clutton Brocker was an absolutely splendid person, but he had a most appalling time, because probation officers said that they were servants of the courts, and they weren't going to have anything to do with all this administration.
Yes. Yes.
So that's kind of how things were. Well, enough of that, do you think?
Yes. Well, can I ask one thing? I mean, a couple of, particularly at the beginning, you commented on the fact that once government's committed to a universal service, then that highlights the problem of so numbers of social work staff. I mean, but whose idea, whose realisation was that?
Because probation and childcare were both responsible for training, I think it was very largely that the local authorities said to the Home Office, look here, we haven't got enough trained people.
Yes.
When they'd accepted the fact that you needed training.
Yes.
But of course it took several years before they did begin to accept that. Sylvia Watson can tell you a lot about that. And the same with local probation committees, that they were saying to the Home Office, look here, we can't get anybody with their in-house training applying for our jobs, and you're saying we ought only to appoint trained people. And it was a new concept, of course, that central authority should in any way make itself responsible for seeing that that the people to man the service were available.
Yes.
And of course the Ministry of Health never really did catch on to it, as Jean Snelling could have told you, either for medical or psychiatric social workers. They thought that that the laws of supply and demand would do it, but of course they didn't. And of course, again around this time, as far as the... No, sorry, let me backtrack. Another thing which brought it all to light was committees of inquiry of the period.
Yes.
For instance, do you know the COPE committees?
Medical auxiliaries.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, yes, of course, the Armed Minister rejected that title.
Yes.
But anyway, the COPE committees did start looking into what we now call deployment, both what was available and the very uneven deployment. And the Institute of Armaments before that had started to try to analyse how many armaments there ought to, how many hospital beds there ought to be to an almoner, according to the particular ward. I mean, it was acute, chronic, or whatever. And their estimate, as a matter of fact, was a very conservative one. I remember taking part in the discussions when they were getting it out, and it's never been met, even although it was such a very modest one. It's never achieved that amount, that standard. So, looking at deployment over the country as a whole, and of course when training started, we used to, as I've said, to talk about desert areas and how you were going to attract people, counteract the drift to the south.
And of course the other side of that is when you suddenly get figures quoted, which are sort of social workers per thousand population.
Mm.
So if you get your own number,
that concept. Mm-hmm. Did we do that in the McIntosh Report? Well, I think we did, but it only rarely came onto the scene with Seebohm, didn't it?
Well, it's in your working party thing, too, isn't it? It's in the Young Husband Report.
No, is it? I'd quite forgotten that. Were we making that calculation?
Yes, you made it and you made the calculation, made it clear in a footnote that the calculation excluded welfare assistance. There were no loopholes for the local authorities.
Oh yes, we had to be awfully careful about loopholes on that one.
There was also a calculation per number of mental health social workers.
Mental welfare, obviously.
I think there might be one other place where there's a figure quoted. Mm. But I think the Young Husband Report.
I ought to remember that. Mm. Mm. Yes, well, these calculations then, we're beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But can we come on to that later?
Yes. Now you'd like to turn off, would you?
Yes. Well, this really is picking up from the... picking up from the Carnegie reports. I suppose the logical path to follow now is the growing realisation that there was a number of separate different social work trainings,
mm-hmm.
all of them, but which had a common core. Would that be fair to say that?
I rather doubt it.
Right.
If you put them all together, yes, I suppose there were a certain number of things in common. But remember, they were of very different lengths and very different educational standards.
Yes.
A lot of the fieldwork was really apprenticeship, not training.
Yes.
What tended to happen was whenever a new service was introduced, a new training was started. So you've got all these different small trainings going on, some in the universities, but quite a lot of them outside the universities, and with very strong commitments to them by the people responsible for them. There were a lot of people who were also beginning to see that change was necessary, but the big practical thing was that change meant finance.
Yes, what you said before that.
Change meant finance. You couldn't change unless you had the money. To do it. Well, when the first Carnegie report came out, there was a discussion in the JUC. They had it in the form of a debate for and against. And it was all inconclusive. And then... the Carnegie trustees set up a committee to have a look at it. And as I said, in the second report, anyway, in that history of social work, that got nowhere.
Yes.
And so it was all kind of stalemate, people feeling that something needed doing.
Yes,
and of course, there was that JUC committee to which you referred. But there wasn't the thrust.
Yes.
Nobody was making a proposal, and there wasn't the finance with which to do it anyway.
Yes.
And it was pretty obvious, of course, that it could only be done in London, because only London had the resources, the resources of fieldwork and the resources of teaching to do it.
Mm.
But Bedford College didn't show any signs of moving, and LSE didn't until Richard Titmuss came.
Yes.
Well, then I've described anecdotally in that last book of mine what happened about that.
But Jean Snelling told me this morning that during the war, I think it was during the war, there was, or just perhaps at the end of the war, the reason why I'm placing you all is because of rationing, because she said you were all together somewhere or other having a conference and realising that all these different types of social worker required a very similar common knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
They had more in common than they had more out of. And she remembers you standing in the doorway of your room where you were staying. And you were discovering that there was a supply of ration-free oatmeal biscuits available in the village.
And, I don't remember.
Going down to get these biscuits because you were starving, hungry and freezing cold.
Oh dear. This must have been, yes, one in the war that that Noel Honeybourne was at, so yes. Ask her about it too. Mm. Yes, you see, the people who thought like Jean Snelling and Noel Honeybourne and so on, came together. It was the people who were thinking on these lines.
Yes.
But then there were all the small specialised courses outside this kind of thinking.
Yes.
And as I said before, there was no, it had to be the impetus from some educational institution that had got the setup to do it. And it had to be financed to do it.
Yes.
No institution would have allocated UGC funds to do it. And remember that that probation and child care were financed to a considerable extent by the Home Office, but financed as such, financed specialised.
Yes.
And of course the others didn't have the finance, and the Ministry of Health wouldn't have been interested. So it was only when Richard Titmuss was convinced the then director at LSE and the Board of Governors, that Richard and I went, well, I wonder whether I ought to backtrack for a moment, because the original proposal had been for an independent school of social work affiliated to a university. We put in for a grant for that purpose from the Social Science Department, and that was instantly turned down.
Yes.
Whereas, as I've said in that last book of mine, it would have made a quite enormous difference if the Carnegie Trust had financed that. But it's no good crying over spilt milk. How much detail do you want me to go into about all this?
Well, I suppose I'm interested. At some point, rather, you went to America, didn't you?
Oh, this is much later. Yes, this is much later. Do you want me to go into all the negotiations which led up to the Carnegie course?
Yeah, well, yes, if you are,
Yeah. Well, then it was, of course, a question when they
said what and so on.
When the Carnegie Trust said that they would give a grant, if the main organisations concerned wanted this and agreed to it.
Yes.
Well, I was in close touch with all of them.
Yes.
And the Institute of Almoners did want it. They had written independently to the Trust. The Family Welfare Association wanted it. They were only a training body of other students. That training of theirs never really took off at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the three that really mattered were the Home Office for Probation and Child Care and the Ministry of Health.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Home Office was divided. I mean, the child care setup was divided. I went one day and had a discussion around the great big conference table with all of them. They were very much divided about it because they were satisfied with their specialised child care courses. They were very much afraid that that a generic course would mean that their numbers grew less.
Yes.
I found that everybody thought that if students trained together, all the students would want to go into a service that wasn't theirs.
Yes.
Each, you see, thought that people would want to go into the other, which of course didn't happen, only marginally.
Can you remember any stories about that? When you said went to the Home Office, they said, who was the childcare department of the Home Office?
Well, the person who was head of the department was John Ross, and he saw the point. The people who did see the point were the very good administrators. They saw the point that all these separations and specializations and special grant aid and all the rest of it were were really counterproductive.
Yes.
And John Ross saw it, and John Ross urged it.
Yes.
Whereas there were one or two other people there who were dead against it.
Yes.
But like good civil servants, once it had become official policy,
yes,
then they supported it.
Yes.
Probation Yes, I think on the whole they supported it more easily. I had a great deal of contact in those days with probation through the juvenile courts, through the consultative committee between the London magistrates and the Home Office, and through membership of the Probation Advisory and Training Board. Yes, they were for it.
Yes.
The PSWs, it's sometimes said that the PSWs decided not to come in.
Mm-hmm.
I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever of there ever being any question mm-hmm. of the mental health course
mm-hmm.
coming in.
Yes.
It would have been much too big, for one thing,
mm-hmm.
to come in with all these small, all the others had to be small groups.
Yes.
If each group had been the same size as the mental health course or the child care course,
yes,
it would have been far too big to be manageable,
yes,
in the circumstances of that time.
Yes.
And moreover, of course, they didn't get grant aid.
Yes, that's
it, yes. Like probation and childcare. So, that...
Were there no Ministry of Health grants to PSWs at that time?
You only got a grant if you'd been refused a grant by a local authority. And sometimes you didn't know until the summer, because
yes,
local authorities usually made these decisions yes. on school examination results.
Yes.
So you didn't know until the summer whether or not you'd got a grant.
Mm.
And so this was really awful for would-be students.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
The Ministry of Health, heaven knows whether it was for it or against it, the person who swung the day was... Geraldine Aves.
Yes.
Are you seeing her, by the by?
Well, she's on one of this enormous list.
Oh, yes, she's a very key person. You certainly ought to see her.
Mm.
Well, she was all in favour of it. Mm. She, of course, was a very good administrator, very much concerned about training.
Yes.
And was a professional social worker.
Mm.
And she persuaded the Ministry of Health
mm.
not to direct it to grant aid, because I think they'd have found that.
Mm.
Not very possible. But what they did do was to allow two hospitals,
mm-hmm.
in the first instance the Middlesex Hospital
mm-hmm.
and Great Ormond Street,
mm-hmm.
to appoint each one of them an extra member of staff
mm-hmm.
who would in fact be a student supervisor.
Yes.
It was a clever way of doing it. You see, it was simply that they could appoint these extra members of staff.
Yes, yes.
So that was the way that the Ministry of Health came in as far as active help was concerned. They also steadily supported
yes.
the idea. Well, then we had this great meeting at LSE with Carl Sanders, CARRSAUNDERS in the chair, and three representatives of the Carnegie trustees, representatives of LSE, and representatives of all the interests that I've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a draft memorandum of assent, I think we called it, which they all had to agree to if the thing was to go through. And it was pretty tense beforehand, wondering whether they all would. I thought they would, because I'd done so much lobbying and so
yes.
much trying to deal with objections.
Yes.
And of course, remember that it did mean their putting in a lot.
Yes.
It meant probation putting in two half-time supervisors,
uh-huh.
childcare putting in, I think it was one whole time supervisor, as far as I remember. So it was a lot in money terms too. And of course it was for these reasons also that they felt it was as much their cause as LSE's cause.
Yes.
And this was one of the reasons for the tremendous blow up later, that they felt that it was quite largely their cause that they hadn't been consulted about decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, then we all were around the boardroom at LSE, and one by one they each said that they supported it and would be willing to sign the memorandum of assent. And I'll never forget the astonishment of the Carnegie trustees, because they hadn't thought that this would be forthcoming.
Mm.
But once it was, then of course it was clear, the go-ahead was clear.
Yes.
It's hard to remember that in those days you could run a course for 4 years on £20,000.
Yes.
Of course LSE put in a certain amount of, they put in all the overheads of accommodation, light, heat, postage, telephone, all that kind of thing.
But, where did you get the ideas from all this? I mean, it's largely your brainchild.
Yes.
And where do the ideas come from?
Well, slowly, as we were saying last time, seeing what was happening in training, feeling that that the social science courses were absolutely splendid. They did change people's lives, even in many ways. As an 85-year-old fellow student of mine said to me on the telephone yesterday, their life had been changed as a result of taking the social science course at LSE. But changing your life doesn't necessarily equip you as a social worker.
No.
And this, as I felt, was the great gap between this first-rate background study and direct performance as a social worker. I felt that people were just not getting any real training, any real background knowledge, real application of the knowledge in practice. And that when agencies complained, as they did, that what were called trained students were no different from the untrained, they were perfectly right as far as actual performance was concerned.
Yes.
I suppose also was experience in the training of youth leaders during the war. There was I didn't remember to mention, but I think it's relevant. The Carnegie Trust gave a grant in those years for a bursary scheme to train club members as club leaders. And I was responsible for that.
Yes.
And that experience showed it also very much how little there was that helped them in their work.
But I mean, you also saw that, I mean, I can understand that point, but I mean, as you said, there were these separate courses which were provided for child care officers and probation officers and medical social workers, how long is that they were. But you presumably, at some point, you must have looked at that and reached the conclusion that basic ideas in common.
Yeah. And oh yes.
How did you get?
Well, if you looked at what social workers were trying to do, if you looked at the knowledge they needed, if you looked at the experience they needed, an expression we used to use a lot at that time. The things that unite are more important than the things that divide. I think it's possible, in the light of subsequent experience, well, I was going to say, I'm not sure I do agree with it, that the genetic principle was carried too far.
Yes.
I think you need specialization, but most emphatically not at the basic training stage, which is what we were concerned with.
Yes. Yes.
Of course, we've been much criticised that there was no group work or community work. Mm. Wasn't that we didn't think about it, we thought about it from the first course onwards. Yes. But group work experience of the kind of, the systematic kind that was available in casework, just didn't exist.
Yes.
And of course, community work only really began in the 1960s.
Yes. Did it begin then, or was it rediscovered then?
It began to be systematised.
Yes. I've got a book at home called Social Workers' Armoury, published by a group called the Brotherhood, or the Christian Brotherhood, or something like that, which is really a community workers' handbook explaining how to use the Public Health Acts to improve housing and so on.
Is it?
I bought it years ago. And
how very interesting.
There seemed to be a whole sort of separate lot of sort of ploys in. Although you were a tight little group at that time, and everybody seems to have known everybody else in social work at that time, very small group. There seemed, from the point of view of social work education and professional organisations, there seemed to be a whole number of separate little movements going on.
There were indeed.
And I can't understand why you never ever at any point came together and said, let's put some order into what really is. Well,
but that's what was being done by the JUC as a result of the Carnegie Report and the groups like Jean Snellen's description.
Yes.
It was steadily happening. Mm. I mean, the Carnegie course couldn't have happened if enough people hadn't wanted it to happen. Mm.
To what extent do you think one of the problems about looking at that the different courses require different levels of education.
Yeah.
And the educational standing.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't necessarily relate to one's capacity as a social worker, but nevertheless, the educational standing of staff in different services varied enormously.
Oh, enormously. And this was one of the difficulties. Mm. I think probably one could say that it was the specialised courses with the best educational standards who saw the need to come together. I'm not sure one can say that the PSWs certainly saw the need for other people to come together.
Yes.
I'm not so sure that they did see the need. They saw that they'd got a very important contribution to make to other people coming together, which is perfectly correct. But that they saw the need for them to come together with other people from their point of view, I think, much less, because they did think they were a superior lot.
Yes, yes.
I think other people agreed, I think on two counts, that it was a much better educational standard that they had in the whole structure of the course.
Mm.
And secondly, of course, the magic of pathology.
Yes, yes. What was your view of that?
Oh, I thought that the mental health courses were absolutely right about their educational structure.
Mm.
Yes, as I said earlier, it never seemed to be practicable that the mental health course should come in from the beginning into the Carnegie course.
I mean, your remark about the magic of pathology.
Well, it did have a magic in those days for very many people.
Mm.
It was much more interesting to know something about mental illness.
Yes.
Though equally at the same time, people were frightened of it. And one of the things that the McIntosh Report discovered was that so few people wanted to be PSWs because they were frightened of mental illness.
Yes, yes.
So there's both the magic and the dread.
Yes, but they were identified with something beyond that as well. I mean, they were with psychopathology in a psychoanalytic sense, weren't they? I remember last time in a previous conversation you talked about the way the PSW course was encapsulated, and once the students were got into that course in that time at all, they were using, you said they were using words like schizoid personality, talking a language nobody else around them could understand.
Yes, I think I ought probably to analyse that further. I think they were encapsulated for two reasons. One was that I think any professional course would have been, because, well, obviously the students would have been out for part of the week on their fieldwork. And so, well, I mean, to some extent, later on, the childcare and applied social studies courses were encapsulated from the general run of the social administration students. For the same reason, because they had lecture courses which were special for them. So there's that reason for encapsulation. And then there's the other one of beginning to speak a special language.
Yes, yes.
And it was very much regarded at that time as some kind of magic. And people used to talk about having X-ray eyes.
Yes.
Seeing into other people with your X-ray eyes. And I don't know whether I don't think I did quote in my book George Newton, who was one of our supervisors, probation, who was an APPO in the London service. And when he was having supervision sessions with students, It was the common practice in the office that you just broke in, you just went into anybody's room if you wanted to ask anything. You just broke in. And he couldn't stand this, of course, in his supervision sessions. So he used to put a notice on the door, an engaged notice on the door, and people wrote underneath, "Congratulations."
Yes. Yeah.
My office in the first days of the Carnegie course was a greenhouse, a very narrow, about as wide as that greenhouse. It's long since pulled down, but the old rectory of St. Clement Danes, the building, had become part of LSE. And the Carnegie course was given a classroom of its own. And an office room. And Kate Lewis and I each had a room, and my room was this greenhouse, which was very narrow. The only heating was an electric fire on the floor. And I remember one day interviewing a very nervous candidate, and all of a sudden, my horror, I smelt burning, and and one of her legs was, well, not her actual leg wasn't sizzling, but she certainly was beginning to catch fire. I told my secretary afterwards, and she said, "Ha, oh, ordeal by fire."
I got mixed up in the timescale about at what point you went to America and met Charlotte Towle, but at some point...
Once the course was agreed, which was in 1953, we had to make the appointments, all the arrangements for the lecturers and the supervisors, and also Kate Lewis, who was the appointed as lecturer in casework. She and I both thought we ought to go to the States, where they were doing so much, where they were so much more advanced in social work education. She went under a United Nations fellowship, and I went under a Smith Mundt, MUNDT, award. And I spent most of the time at the School of Social Service Administration in Chicago, trying to convince Charlotte Towle to come over, because a number of people, Sybil Clement Brown included, had thought that she would be much the best person to come. And so I was there having a lovely time, being partly a student and partly mixing with all the staff and having a very good time with them. So I saw it from both ends, and trying to persuade her to come. Well, she finally did agree, and then it was held up for 3 months because it was the McCarthy period.
Yes.
And her visa was, she was refused a visa because it was said that she had engaged in subversive activities.
Yes.
And the U.S. Educational Committee,
yes.
U.S. Educational Commission had a committee here of which Richard Titmus and I and a number of other people were members. And we heard about the visa having been refused, and we resigned, the whole committee resigned.
Yes.
And this went through to Washington.
Yes.
And they changed their minds about the visa, and she came.
Yes. Was it, her subversive activities,
Well, she couldn't think of any. She finally came to the conclusion. There was a great woman called Grace Abbott who had been Dean of the School of Social Service Administration. And she used to get materials sent to her from all kinds of way-off fringe organizations, which she never looked at herself, but she used to pass them on to Charlotte. And Charlotte couldn't think of anything excepting that that this stuff had landed on her desk over the years.
Yes. Yes. Gosh. One of my conversations has been with Ilse Westheimer.
Oh, has she?
The New York School.
She was on the faculty there.
And she said the Carnegie Building there. Was it Carnegie House, it's called, was the only place where she felt you could speak freely at that time.
Gosh, was it really?
During this, the McCarthy time, that there are certain areas people just wouldn't talk about. They'd say, I prefer not to talk about that. If there were other people present, they didn't know.
Well, equally, I remember at the height of the period, having lunch or supper in a crowded restaurant with a friend of mine who was a civil servant and was in the Department of Health, Education and Welfare. And I remember her talking in a clear, loud voice about all her feelings about it and giving examples. And I was absolutely astonished that she did, but she had no inhibitions and nobody seemed to notice.
She wasn't trying to speak out now.
No, not a bit. So I think it did vary quite tremendously.
So you did persuade Charlotte Terrell to come back?
Yes, and it was an enormous success. She loved it and always wanted to come back.
Yes.
But alas. And of course, she made a very big difference because she took seminars for experienced social workers and social work teachers, and a lot got through, through her. And we all worked together very happily, that whole group.
When you said just now that you wondered whether genericism had been taken too far, in the end, I mean, how did you mean exactly?
Oh, I meant in practice, I meant the Seaborn Committee's recommendation of one social worker for the family. I think wherever it's possible, yes. But I think experience has shown that that the range is far too wide. And that they get too little experience of any one group.
Yes.
For instance, foster home placement.
Yes.
Geriatric services.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's, I suppose it's a lot to expect of someone to, who's had a generalised training experience to suddenly relate that to an across-the-board selection of...
Because the Carnegie course was something very different. For good or ill, there were people on it who were committed to specific services.
Yes.
And of course they had the settings courses, which I think ought to have been comparative, but anyway, that wasn't possible at that time.
Yes. Comparative in the sense...
Well, it ought to have been classes comparing practices in different agencies and the reasons for them, rather than separate for childcare, probation, medical, social work.
Yes. Yes. But yes, I mean, but the trouble is that we always seem to sort of allow ourselves sort of very, so little time to pack in so many different ideas.
Oh, I know.
Really the ideal is both sorts of classes. The comparative and classes and specific classes for a specific working group.
I think it's very possible that that educationally the much more limited coverage of the early applied social studies courses did give students more of a springboard than the enormously packed courses of the present day, particularly the 1 year postgraduate courses.
Yes. Well, can we move on from Carnegie and to the next landmark, which I suppose is the Working Party.
Yeah, social workers of the local authority, health and welfare services.
Really was a mammoth.
It is a mouthful. I think on the other tape I talked about the JUC deputation, several government departments, and how that got nowhere. Well, I suspect that setting up of that working party was very much the initiative of Geraldine Abbes. Anyway, one day now, I always get this woman's name wrong. Dame Enid Russell Smith.